saying, have a lovely day.
Today is Wednesday, September the 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. The top U.S. military officer told Congress on Tuesday that the two calls he made to his Chinese counterpart in the last month of the Trump administration were made openly and in response to legitimate concerns.
My task at that time was to de-escalate. My message again was consistent. Stay calm, steady, and de-escalate. We are not going to attack you.
And 30 international and local organizations issued a joint open letter to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and permanent representatives of Security Council member states, asking them to take urgent action to end violence and famine in Tigray.
Since the blockade went into effect, the UN estimates that it's needed about 8,000 trucks or so of aid to go in. That's about 100 trucks a day. So far in that period of time, last couple of months, we've seen about 400 plus trucks go through. So that gives you a feeling for how bad it is.
And concern is growing over the reach of China's so-called national security law that it recently imposed on Hong Kong. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition, so stay tuned. And for our top story, the Biden administration says COVID-19 vaccine booster campaign is off to a strong start days after federal regulators approved shots for millions of Americans. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani has more.
White House Virus Response Coordinator Jeff Zients says at pharmacies alone last weekend,
over 400,000 Americans received the additional protection of a booster.
Zients says the focus remains on the roughly 25% of eligible Americans who have not yet gotten their first vaccine dose. CDC Chief Rochelle Walensky says a particular group is concerning.
About 30% of women who are pregnant right now are vaccinated, an extraordinarily low number.
And just 15% of black pregnant women. Walensky says data show the shots are safe for both mother and baby. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The Pentagon's top officer says that the U.S. should have kept several thousand more troops in Afghanistan. AP's Sagar Meghani joins us again with this report.
Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley says there's no sugarcoating how the war ended.
An outcome that is a strategic failure.
At a Senate hearing, Milley and Central Command Chief Frank McKenzie said their personal opinions are troops should have stayed behind in Afghanistan, but both refused to say if that's the advice they gave President Biden in the spring.
I won't give you my recommendation. I've given you my view.
The president told ABC News last month no senior military leader recommended against a full withdrawal. Spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the advice was split.
Ultimately, regardless of the advice, it's his decision. He's the commander in chief.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley defended phone calls to his Chinese counterpart in the final weeks of the Trump administration and a decision to call a meeting of senior military officials to review the procedures for launching deadly weapons. General Mark Milley, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, said that the calls were generated by concerning intelligence that caused American officials to believe that the Chinese were worried about an attack on them by the U.S.
These military-to-military communications at the highest level are critical to the security of the United States in order to deconflict military actions, manage crisis, and prevent war between great powers that are armed with the world's most deadliest weapons. The calls on 30 October and 8 January were coordinated before and after with Secretary Esper and Acting Secretary Miller's staffs and the interagency. The specific purpose of the October and January calls were generated by concerning intelligence, which caused us to believe the Chinese were worried about an attack on them by the United States. I know, I am certain that President Trump did not intend to attack the Chinese, and it is my directed responsibility, and it was my directed responsibility by the Secretary to convey that intent to the Chinese. My task at that time was to de-escalate. My message again was consistent. stay calm, steady, and de-escalate. We are not going to attack you.
That was the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, testifying before Congress on Tuesday. Britain's government sees signs of stabilization in the fuel supply crisis. AP's Charles de la Desma has more.
Transport Minister Grant Shapps says there are tentative signs the fuel crisis snarling the country is easing, but it will be a while before the situation returns to normal, he adds. He's urging people not to hoard gasoline, calling that extremely unhelpful. Many gas stations around Britain have shut in the past few days because they've run out of fuel, with lines of vehicles at pumps that are open and tempers fraying amid hours-long waits. The government has put army troops on standby to help get gas to stations and help ease the crisis triggered by a shortage of truck drivers. Charles de la Desma, London.
The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffith says that it is in his assumption that famine has taken hold in Ethiopia's Tigray region, where a de facto blockade has restricted deliveries to only 10% of aid to the region. Meanwhile, 30 international and local organizations issued a joint open letter to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and permanent representatives of Security Council member states, asking them to take urgent action to end violence and famine in Tigray. The letter says that since November 2020, civilians in northern Ethiopia had been cut off from assistance, banking, and communications, leaving almost 1 million people to experience famine conditions. Hardin Lang is the vice president of Refugees International, one of the organizations that signed that letter. He joins me from his office in Washington, D.C., and I asked him to give us an update on what many say is a deliberate blockade of aid going to the region.
Sure, Jackson. Thanks for having me. I think we're in a situation where the ongoing famine conditions and humanitarian crisis inside of Tigray itself is now being augmented by additional sort of fighting and displacement in surrounding regions. So what we've seen over the last couple of months is the conflict begin to spread out beyond the borders of Tigray into Amhara and Afar. Inside of Tigray itself, what we've seen is a continuation of the blockade, what amounts to a blockade by the government of Ethiopia. And there, you know, the situation for over 5 million people living inside, hunger remains an incredibly acute condition, with a million plus people living in something approaching famine conditions. And the number of an amount of humanitarian assistance that's getting in is still just a fraction of what's required.
And so 30 organizations, including yours, issued a letter, an open letter to the UN Secretary General. Can you tell us a little bit what this letter calls for, what it's asking for?
Yeah, sure. So the letter was signed by about 30 different civil society organizations and umbrella groups. So in many of these umbrella groups, there's a number of other organizations. And what we're trying to do is increase sort of the pressure and public awareness around the fact that this crisis inside of Tigray is continuing to degenerate, with the goal of putting real pressure on the United Nations Secretary General and perhaps more importantly, members of the Security Council to actually take more concrete action to get involved in the resolution of the crisis. In particular, what we're looking for is first a humanitarian ceasefire of some form. And that's not just the government of Ethiopia and forces allied with it, but that's also the Tigrayan defense forces, who are at the moment the ones who have the initiative on the battlefield, not only immediately outside Tigray, but also in some of the surrounding regions. So we want to see all the parties sort of agree to a ceasefire. We want to see the Ethiopian government very quickly open up access of the blockade. So right now, since the blockade went into effect, the UN estimates that it's needed over about 8,000 trucks or so of aid to go in. That's about 100 trucks a day. So far in that period of time, the last couple of months, we've seen about 400 plus trucks go through. So that gives you a feeling for how bad it is.
Right.
In addition, we want to see some humanitarian monitors deployed to be able to watch what's happening inside of Tigray and watch the aid being delivered, and really encourage, finally, as a final step, more increased sort of an inclusive political process that will bring all the parties to the conflict to the table across Ethiopia.
Now, the Ethiopian government could have control over its military, but we are talking about a situation where, like you say, various militia groups have now become active combatants in this conflict, many operating without control from the central government. Are there efforts to engage with these groups?
That's absolutely right. And that's why the situation is becoming increasingly dangerous now, because you see some of the alliances that are being formed across sort of ethnically based or communal based militia organizations now are sort of supersede the boundaries of particular regional regions of the country. And many of these are sort of immediately outside the control of the government. And so now what you see is the conflict beginning to generate its own momentum. And these, the different actors need to come to the table, and there needs to be a very concerted effort by the international community, the African Union, the United Nations, and key donors and regional stakeholders to get the parties to the conflict to the table to begin to talk about not only a ceasefire, but the broad outlines of a political solution.
And what kind of influence can the UN exert on the Ethiopian government to make them comply with these demands that you're making in this letter?
It's an excellent question. I mean, I think the pressure looks comes in a couple of different forms. The first thing is that the Security Council really needs to take ownership of this issue. And we're very pleased to see that for the first time, we believe that Ethiopia and the crisis in Ethiopia is going to appear formally on the calendar in October for discussion. And so we think that's going to move forward. We're also grateful to see that members of the Security Council and the Secretary General are increasingly beginning to use sort of more pointed rhetoric in talking about who is responsible. At the end of the day, the UN simply needs to hold to account the parties to the conflict and the government of Ethiopia. But then countries like the United States, which exert more direct pressure, need to work in concert, right, with the UN and the other members of the Security Council. And you see the United States coming out and doing some fairly strong things in recent weeks. For example, we've seen the US put into place or seek establish the authority to exercise sanctions over individuals responsible for human rights abuse, atrocity, and then keeping humanitarian aid from flowing into areas where it's needed. Now, they haven't put those sanctions into effect yet. They simply said, the Biden administration simply said that they've got the authority to do it. And they say, if we don't see behavior change in a couple of key areas, they're going to put those into place. And so what needs to happen is those sanctions need to be married with a political strategy to get the various parties of the conflict to the table under the threat of sanction, but with the United Nations and the African Union convening to begin to look at sort of workable and concrete solutions to improve the situation on the ground.
That was Hadin Lang. He's the Vice President of Refugees International here in Washington, D.C. Lebanon has been experiencing an outbreak of food poisoning, according to local media reports and non-government organizations. The chronic electronic blackouts in the country have rendered the process of refrigerating food properly almost impossible. A recent study by the American University in Beirut showed that more than 40% of the food samples collected from supermarkets in Beirut and its suburbs were microbiologically not acceptable. George Eid reports for VOA from Beirut.
This year, cases of food poisoning in Lebanon have been rising compared to the past years. The main reason for this is that the country is experiencing continued power cuts. The Lebanese government still does not have the funds needed to import fuel to the country. The restaurant sector and thousands of homes are suffering from a lack of electricity. Many are unable to keep their fridges running and are always at risk of having their food getting spoiled. Local media has been reporting on this issue. There has been numerous reports of food poisoning cases, and the Ministry of Economy's hotline is receiving dozens of calls every day from people who have been poisoned. An-Nahar, a local daily, has warned in an article it published that cases of food poisoning are rising at an alarming rate in Lebanon. Joel Hajmoussa, who got poisoned recently after eating at a local restaurant in Beirut, says it was very disturbing.
I was poisoned by cheese. The problem is that I couldn't find the medicine in any of more than 10 pharmacies around. So I asked my friends to search for me for the medicine. And when I found it, I was surprised that its price is twice the basic price.
A recent study published by the American University of Beirut's Laboratory of Food Safety and Microbiology showed worrying amounts of E. coli bacteria in cheese sourced from Beirut. These samples were taken from supermarkets in Beirut and its suburbs, 40 to 45% of them were not microbiologically acceptable, the study found. Medical doctor Evelyn Hitti, a professor of clinical emergency from the same university that published the study, explains that the number of patients hospitalized for food poisoning is growing.
In Lebanon, this past season has been particularly challenging, especially with intestinal infections and foodborne illnesses. As we saw, food storage get compromised with increasing electricity outages and impacting the quality of food that everybody is ingesting. So what ended up happening is an increase in load of intestinal infections that are commonly caused by Shigella, Salmonella, and E. coli, resulting from poor food storage.
Many people have started avoiding dairy products or frozen meat in fear that they might not have been well refrigerated. The consumer protection rights NGO president Zuhair Birru explains that this is a situation they had predicted and warned against on many occasions. He says, "We have warned many times about food poisoning for a while now. The first reason is the blackouts, of course. The second reason are unethical suppliers who are delivering products to shops knowing they were not well refrigerated in an effort to make money. This is a widespread crisis in Lebanon now, and the government is not doing anything about it." The Lebanese government is still unable to come up with a solution to the power cuts, and the Ministry of Energy has warned that the country will face a total blackout in a few days if fuel is not imported. This is George Aid reporting for VOA from Beirut.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization is calling for action to stem food loss and waste, which it says are a major cause of hunger and malnutrition around the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
FAO experts say countries currently are producing enough food to feed the nearly 8 billion people who populate the world, yet more than 800 million are going hungry. Another 2 billion people, they say, are suffering from nutrition deficiencies, which can cause serious health problems. The deputy director of the FAO's Food and Nutrition Division, Nancy Aborto, says millions of children suffer stunting and wasting, which are deadly forms of undernutrition, and one in three adults are overweight or obese. That, she says, is another form of undernutrition caused by inadequate vitamins, minerals, and unhealthy diets.
And the high cost of healthy diets have put healthy diets out of reach for billions of people around the world, in every region around the world, including Europe. And this trend has been seen to get worse during the COVID-19 pandemic. And without healthy diets, we can never address the problems of hunger and malnutrition.
A 2019 FAO study found an estimated 14% of food produced globally spoils or is ruined from post-harvest to the point of sale. Another study by the UN Environment Program this year shows an estimated 17% of food that is available to consumers is wasted. The United Nations says around one-third of all food, or 1.3 billion tons of food, produced globally ends up rotting in retail market or consumer trash bins. UN economists value the loss at around $1 trillion a year. Aborto warns the UN will never reach its sustainable development goal of zero hunger by 2030 if food loss and waste continues unchecked. She says the ongoing problem also undermines the sustainability of global food systems for the future.
Food loss and waste account for approximately 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions, while food that's lost or wasted, all of the resource that went into producing it, including water, land, energy, labor, and capital, all go to waste. Reducing food loss and waste can lead to greater availability and accessibility of healthy diets and reduce hunger and malnutrition, but this is not guaranteed.
The FAO has declared this Wednesday to be International Day of Awareness of Food Loss and Food Waste. Aborto says reducing food loss and waste would lead to healthier, more nutritious diets, decrease world hunger, and result in environmental benefits. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in other news, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told lawmakers on Tuesday that the government could run out of cash by October 18th unless Congress acts to lift the federal debt limit in advance of the Treasury Department exhausting efforts to preserve resources. And Germany's Social Democrats, who narrowly won Sunday's national elections ahead of Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives, said on Tuesday that they hoped to talk to the Greens and Free Democrats later this week about forming a three-way government. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Controllers will be taking a two-week break from sending operational commands to NASA's Six Mars exploration missions. Rick Pantaleo tells us about it in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says controllers for their six Mars exploration missions will take a break from sending operational commands to their orbiters, landers, and rovers from October 2nd through October 16th. The reason for the two-week transmission hiatus will be due to something called a Mars solar conjunction. That's when the orbits of Earth and the red planet are in positions where the sun blocks the view of each other. Officials at NASA say they established this moratorium because of concerns that any signals sent to the robotic explorers could be corrupted and cause operational problems. Mission controllers will send a list of simple commands to their devices to carry on their work during the moratorium. A few missions will continue to send some data back to Earth, but all will save its gathered data for retransmission after the moratorium. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. Concern is growing over the breach of China's so-called national security law that it recently imposed on Hong Kong. Britain warned several of its citizens that they could face arrest and extradition to the former British colony. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
China imposed the national security law on Hong Kong in June 2020 in response to anti-government protests, claiming it would restore order to the territory. Critics say it curtails basic democratic freedoms. Well over 100 people have been arrested under the legislation. Among them is opposition activist Andy Lee, who was charged with foreign collusion in 2020 after allegedly lobbying foreign governments to impose sanctions on Hong Kong and China. Several British citizens were named in the court papers. Earlier this month, the British government told them they could face arrest and extradition to Hong Kong if they travelled to any country that had an extradition agreement with the Chinese territory. Among them was US-born British citizen Bill Browder, who has campaigned globally for so-called Magnitsky sanctions against human rights abusers.
Specifically, my name was mentioned because I was having discussions with various people about Magnitsky sanctions against the Hong Kong officials who were involved in this suppression of democracy. After alerting me to my name being in the document, the Foreign Office officials pointed out to me that the Chinese national security law doesn't just apply domestically to residents of Hong Kong, it applies to anyone, anywhere in the world.
Browder has already faced several attempts by Russia to have him arrested and extradited on fraud charges through Interpol, the global agency that communicates arrest warrants between police forces. Browder says the charges are clearly politically motivated.
I basically contain my travel to what I describe as rule of law countries. So, for example, I won't travel to South Africa, even though I actually own a home in South Africa, because it's not really considered to be a rule of law country. Whereas I would travel to Germany, regardless of what treaties they have, because I know that a German court will not hand me over to Russians or Chinese on politically motivated cases.
More than a dozen countries have extradition agreements with Hong Kong, including India, South Africa, and Portugal. British pro-democracy activist Luke de Pulford was also named in the Hong Kong court papers and approached by the British Foreign Office.
It's a really sad indictment and reflection on the UK's cowering before China. We're now in a situation that, having failed to honour their promises to the people of Hong Kong, the UK is telling people that they can't go to third countries because they might end up in prison.
under the joint declaration signed between Britain and China before the 1997 handover of Hong Kong, Beijing promised to maintain the territory's autonomy under the so-called Basic Law. In a statement, the British government told VOA, "The UK will not look the other way on Hong Kong, and we will not duck our historic responsibilities to its people. As a co-signatory to the joint declaration, we will continue to stand up for the people of Hong Kong." Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Australia is under growing international pressure to commit to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, but the policy is fiercely dividing its centre-right government. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
Australia is one of the world's major exporters of coal and gas. Coal is mined in every Australian state. Most exports go to countries in Asia, including China, Japan and South Korea. In 2020, exports were worth about $39 billion. Trade has almost doubled in the past decade. But China's informal import restrictions on Australian coal saw the value of exports fall sharply, although prices have started to recover. Coal also generates about 70% of Australia's electricity. Coal-fired power makes it the most carbon-polluting nation per capita in the world. Prime Minister Scott Morrison is planning to eventually shift his country's reliance on coal and gas in favour of clean energy technologies, a shift from his time as Treasurer in 2017. In support of the mining industry, then Treasurer Morrison brought a piece of coal to Parliament to argue the need to continue producing coal in a famous scene.
"This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal that has delivered prosperity to Australian businesses and has ensured that Australian industry has been able to remain competitive on a global market."
Clean energy is still an issue that deeply divides his centre-right governing coalition. Some members of the National Party, the junior alliance partner, are adamant that Australia's coal industry is too valuable to lose and insist it will thrive for decades. Many regional communities depend on it. There's also disagreement about committing to a target of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. The Prime Minister said he wants to achieve net zero emissions as soon as possible, but hasn't outlined any measures to do so. But government lawmaker Trent Zimmerman says Australia must join the global push to reduce emissions.
"We need both the target and the plan that matches it. It's very hard to divorce the two. And obviously, much of the international community has moved in that direction. In fact, 80% of global emissions or thereabouts are covered by pledges that relate to reaching net zero. So it is important for Australia that we are part of that because it's the right thing to do."
Morrison has said he's yet to decide whether he will attend the Glasgow Climate Change Conference, known as COP26, in November. He told a newspaper that he wanted to oversee Australia's eventual emergence from COVID-19 lockdowns. His critics insist he's too embarrassed by his government's climate change policies to attend the summit in the Scottish capital. Opinion polls by the Australia Institute, an independent public policy think tank based in Canberra, have shown that most Australians want stronger measures to curb emissions. A United Nations climate change report recently warned that global warming will inflict more severe and frequent drought, storms, heat waves and bushfires in Australia. However, those surveys reported by the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper also revealed support for the coal industry. Less than half of Australians believe that coal power should be phased out within a decade. Australia's addiction to fossil fuels might be hard to give up, according to the survey. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day ahead.
The World Health Organization
and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease